recalibrate the role of vice president. I missed the part in Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution about kissing the president's ass 24/7, but apparently Pence found it. CPAC. If you're not a conservative, it will be hard to understand just how important the American Conservative Union and the Conservative Political Action Committee annual conference was to the movement. I use the term was advisedly, because as soon as the CPAC leadership got a hint of Trumpism, it deviated from literally every value it had worked for over the long march and embraced him with vigor. Let me give you a quick and dirty look at CPAC before we go too much further. A conference of conservatives may sound to the layperson like some boring God Squad event where middle-aged dudes in suits sit in seminars about the benefits of entitlement reform on long-term sovereign debt loads. Nothing could be further from the truth. Lest any of you think conservatives believe in no sex before or outside of marriage, CPAC is a place where young conservatives go to engage in some mindless, consequence-free fucking. People there are rather more likely to be swiping on Tinder than reading National Review. It's a place where the M4M Craigslist ads suddenly pop with lines like, clean-cut free-market conservative seeks dirty liberal bear. It's the Rumspringa for Hillsdale students, young Republicans, college Republicans, and conservative activists from across the country. CPAC and ACU were always in a scramble for the unicorn intersection of American politics and celebrity. They were always seeking celebrity special guests that could draw a crowd. Arnold Schwarzenegger was about the pinnacle of celebrity at the conference until CPAC's major domo decided to bring in Trump in 2011. It was both a preview of Trump's campaign to come and an early warning signal of the death watch of the GOP. Trump combined a few things that the CPAC audience loved. Fuck you swagger, a confrontational attitude, and an entertaining show. I'm sure the first outing was a win-win for the host of the popular reality TV game show and for the ACU. He was a good draw, but no one thought he was really part of the conservative movement. At the grassroots, this was an era when the Ron Paul CPAC machine could still stack a straw poll, and when the conservative movement was flush with the 2010 victory. When Trump returned in 2013, he and Sarah Palin had longer speaking times and better slots on the schedule than Paul Ryan, Marco Rubio, and Rand Paul, all of whom were, at the time, considered the future of the GOP. It was another missed signal that the entertainment wing of the GOP was going to do everything it could to put crowd-pleasing yahoos front and center at CPAC's annual conclave. The conservative apparatus was infected with Trumpism for a host of reasons, but in a blistering essay in March 2016, Matt Cover hit the essential blunder of the entertainment wing and the CPAC conservatives right on the head. He wrote, quote, "To aid their growing grassroots campaign, movement leaders began inviting Donald Trump into the fold, giving him prime speaking slots at the Conservative Political Action Conference and other grassroots events. They hoped to leverage Trump's celebrity and rhetorical skill to help push their message into the broader media environment. It would prove a disastrous blunder. Trump, ever the narcissist and self-promoter, stole the movement's intra-party revolution away from Cruz and his Washington allies. Trump's superior celebrity and mastery of the modern media have allowed him to seize on the ignorance created by the movement's phony anti-establishment campaign. He has, with frightening skill, channeled the misplaced frustration and mistrust carefully sown over the past 7 years by movement organizations and entertainers." End quote. The rest of the professional conservative establishment, from Grover Norquist's Americans for Tax Reform to the Heritage Foundation, group after group, abandoned any pretense of adhering to their formerly held beliefs and became cheerleaders for Trump. Did some see this as an uncomfortable bow to the inevitable? Surely. The small-dollar donors to these groups were always more fringe and less sophisticated than their Washington leadership. They watched the Fox coverage, saw their social media landscape, and decided that embracing Trump and nationalist populism would, at the least, let them live to fight another day. Lobbyists. It must be the broad, masochistic streak among lobbyists that keeps legions of dominatrixes in business in Washington, D.C. For all their disdain of Trump as a clown, a joke, and a human train wreck, they sat quietly at first as he dumped his vitriol on them. At the beginning of the 2016 election campaign, most of them expected a Hillary win, and even Republicans didn't see that outcome as the end of the world. Hillary was explicable. She was transactional. She was, in short, their dream date. At a minimum, they could scare the hell out of their clients with Hillary, leading to higher fees and bigger battles. They could work around, or even quietly with Hillary, monetizing the threat she posed to their clients, dragging out legislative fights year after profitable year. Given Trump's ego, shallow understanding of the world as it exists beyond the Fox and Friends bubble, and obvious full-frontal venality, something became clear. They sensed that if Trump did make it to the Oval Office, it would be a golden age on K Street. The man was crony capitalism in human form, and subject to the kind of flattery in which the lobbying community excels. If you've spent much time around lobbyists, you know the spiel. Why, yes, Donald, you are the tallest, most handsome, smartest man in the room, and this room on your beautiful Trump-branded property, which I will use for all my future meetings, is the classiest and most elegant room I've ever seen. Is that real gold? So luxurious. Sex with my wife? Feel free. In short, they recognize that Trump might be a master con man, but his tells, blind spots, ego needs, and vanity could put them in the driver's seat. So as much as Trump insulted and demeaned Washington's Republican swamp dwellers and promised to crush their lives and incomes, these masters of passive-aggressive behavior bowed meekly and slipped their necks into the leash the moment he was nominated. They were topping from the bottom with Trump, but he didn't understand how they played him, and still doesn't. This transition wasn't as difficult for the lobbying community as you might think. Lobbyists have seen the ebb and flow of political power in D.C. for generations, and switched smoothly when a majority party becomes a minority party, or even when the ideological temperature cools and warms. They're supposed to do this. Their job is to advocate for their clients with people in power. Many of them do have ideological foundations and long-term party affiliations, but it was understandable, if a little frustrating, to see people who months before were shoveling money to Hillary or Jeb or Marco or Ted suddenly become born-again Trumpers, their bespoke MAGA hats resting uncomfortably on their $400 haircuts. With majorities in the House and Senate, they saw that the path to success was to strap on the rhetorical and financial knee pads and worship at the foot of the orange one. These people are a million miles from the lives and experiences of the average Trump voter, and they're precisely the kind of lifelong politicians and corrupt insiders whom residents of Trump Nation blame for everything, from illegal immigration to Obamacare to the return of Zima. The D.C. types suddenly hoisting overpriced cocktails in the Trump Hotel hadn't changed their views. They just raised a flag of convenience with a golden T in its center. Could they have turned their considerable resources and energies to defeating Trump? Absolutely. Their clients are the lifeblood of major donor money and command many billions. They could have darkened the sky with the ashes of the Trump campaign in the early primary if they'd chosen to do so. Instead, they advised their clients in corporate America to hold their fire. They sat quietly and watched the world burn. Major donors. The major donor community, too, could have stopped Donald Trump in 2015. It would have cost them almost nothing. If they'd chosen to hammer Trump with ads early and often, the spring primary elections in 2016 might have looked a lot different. Instead, they played the dumbest game of political calculus I've ever seen. I witnessed this line of thinking iterated among a dozen mega donor conversations and email chains within days of Trump's descent down the gold-plated escalator in Trump Tower. It went something like this. Well, I'm with Jeb now, but we're going to wait to hit Trump until he takes out Marco. Well, I'm with Marco, but we're going to wait until he takes out Jeb and Ted. Well, I'm with Ted now, but if we attack Trump, we're really attacking the voters Ted needs to beat Marco. On and on it went, reductive as hell and dumber than dirt. Most legitimately believed Trump would self-destruct, and their chosen candidate would rise. In fairness, we all thought Trump's self-destructive tendencies would end him. But in my case, I knew he needed a push off the ledge. Sadly, I'm not a billionaire. I know, right? It's a source of constant frustration. And couldn't fund a national ad effort against Trump. The people who could elected to sit on their hands. Some donors worried that Trump would target them personally. Some worried that their brands or businesses would suffer when a man with tens of millions of rabid Twitter followers turned his ire on them with his weapon of choice, rage tweets. They were right about that, but for the wrong reason. His social media attacks were powerful, but ultimately inconsequential to corporate bottom lines. They also thought if they poked the orange bear, he'd become so enraged that he'd outspend their candidates by putting his own money in the race. That's where they got it really, really wrong. There's always been a single central signifier in the myth of Donald Trump. whether as a developer, a casino operator, or a reality TV host, or a branding pitchman, or a presidential candidate. The idea that Trump is wealthy to the tune of his often claimed $10 billion. His branding depended on it, no matter how many not our kind dear and not quite our class signals his vulgar affect sent to people with real money. Everyone believed it. Hell, even I believed it. Combined with Trump's utter lack of transparency regarding his fantasy finances and his refusal to release his tax returns, even wealthy mega donors had little to go on. Forbes was skeptical, calling out Trump's financial bullshitting, but political professionals neglected to perform due diligence and simply assumed he could bring serious cash to the game. By August 2015, I was working to convince major donors of Trump's long-term existential threat to the country and the party. We thought he would be a destructive force and likely throw the race to Hillary Clinton. One moment from that period sticks with me as a turning point in my thinking about Trump's money. A major Wall Street donor, a hedge fund manager who had survived 2008, 2000, and 1987 looking like a genius, laughed when I told him we'd need to mount a serious and fully funded effort to take on Donald Trump if he chose to self-fund. My friend scoffed at the very idea that Trump was worth even a quarter of the mythical $10 billion, much less that he was liquid to the tune of more than $200 million. My friend said, "He's not a billionaire. I'm a billionaire. He's a clown living on credit." However, in a year of voter disenchantment and outsider cachet, the mythic tales of Trump's business prowess and his alleged wealth deeply impressed his fans, and even convinced many Republican megadonors that Trump was an unalloyed business success, a man of global financial consequence uncorrupted by the venal horrors of the campaign finance system. His claim to being self-funding was a home run in campaign focus groups. By late 2015, everyone in politics had heard a variation of this message 100 times in focus group interviews and on social media. Mr. Trump isn't a politician. He's rich and no one owns him. Because 35% of the GOP believe the marketing of the Trump brand, amplified by America's addiction to reality television, the power of Trump's alleged billions cast a long political shadow. The specter of Trump's money haunted the other presidential candidates in the Gang of 17, who largely, and until far too late, pulled their punches lest he unleash a media firestorm paid for from his pocket. That fear of Trump's resources sent Reince Priebus scurrying like a terrified hobbit to the barred door of the Trump empire to beg the Orange Lord to sign a pledge he wouldn't run as a third-party candidate. The thought that Trump could easily fund a third-party bid was a cheap form of political blackmail against the donors and candidates, and it worked. It was a classic Trump con. Aside from a few newsworthy catches like Sheldon Adelson, Trump the candidate never managed to convince the donor class he should have their support. After his election, of course, the money rolled in, and the donors who despised and mocked Trump were quick to write checks to the inaugural committee. Almost to a man, they loathed Trump with gusto. I went back to review a memo I sent to donors in July of 2015. In it, I warned, "We can spend a few million now to stop Trump, tens of millions if we wait until the fall of 2015, or hundreds of millions in the spring of 2016. Or just wait until he destroys the GOP, and we'll spend several billion to rebuild our party brand and undo the damage a generation of far-left governance will cause. Your call." When I saw a 6-figure donation to the Trump inaugural committee from a major donor with a robust dislike of Trump, I tweaked him in a playful email with a copy of that memo attached. His forward response by text message was, "Yeah, fuck me, right?" Men like my friend aren't uncommon in the major donor community. Some are so wealthy that Trump's actual net worth was rounding error to them. But they weren't, as a rule, bold enough to put their money on the line to defeat him. A few still comfort themselves with the knowledge that the tax bill will pad their bottom lines nicely. Some hope that someday, somehow, he'll stop tweeting and won't get us into a nuclear war. Many still quietly regret their inaction. Those who don't yet will. The Republican Consulting Class. As a Republican consultant for over 30 years now, I don't expect you to love me. Honestly, I expect you to think of me as being morally ambiguous, politically opportunistic, vicious, spiteful, and committed to my bottom line before anything good or wholesome. Spoiler, mostly true. This has never been a business, particularly my former niche of campaign advertising, informed merely by a deep sense of wonder at the miracle of our republic. Just when, baby? As consultants, we're supposed to be a few steps ahead of the curve. We're paid to put knowledge and foresight about the secret desires of voters into action, and to play a strategic game for our candidates and clients over a span of years. Perhaps it's a sign that I've become as jaded as a Vegas stripper that even I was stunned by how the Republican consulting community went from being almost universally opposed to Trump and operating with the ability to see where he'd lead the party, to cheerleading for Trump as the next messiah, proclaiming his glory to their clients. A lot of them are smart enough to know better and are more engaged with the actual issues, so that it's hard for them to simply play dumb, pretending Trump isn't a liability. Those folks knew from the jump Trump wasn't one of them, and never would be. They knew a flag of convenience when they saw one. They simply didn't give a damn. It's a question that's haunted me since their collapse in the era of Trump. Were they faking then, or are they faking now? Is the mere course of just win, baby, expedience for the election cycle, or is there ever a point where they say, no mas? From all the Vichy Republicans, Trump demanded a fundamental compromise. He demanded they look back on their records of 10 or 20 or 30 years in public life and say, what I really meant was, and then launch into a gusher of praise for Donald Trump. He demanded they bend and bend until their bones snapped, pretending on friendly conservative media outlets like Fox that Trump's actions, character, and policies are from the mainstream of conservative thought, and ranting about fake news to the rest of the media. In the campaign, they enabled Trump. In government, it's more of the same, just louder and dumber. They've engaged in an Orwellian erasure of what conservatism represents. We have always been at war with East Asia. Perhaps all of this gave the Vichy Republicans and their allies a moment's pause from time to time, but most seem to have turned in their principles at the door. What to expect when you're working for Trump? Act 2. You breeze through your confirmation hearings, greased by Mitch McConnell's desire to avoid angering the tweeter-in-chief. Democratic critics are like mosquitoes, small and annoying, but of little consequence. You didn't really have to do much more than show up. Hell, you thought it would be easy, but not this easy. The few perfunctory questions from the Republicans were mostly about how much you loved them and they loved you. The Democrats were a little harder, but really, you were back at the BLT Prime restaurant in the Trump Hotel by 5 p.m. Everyone's there. Scaramucci holding court. Reince and Walsh and their old guard types at a table, all consumed by their iPhones. Kellyanne. Bannon being Bannon, sitting in a booth with that creepy little beanbag Matt Boyle. Spice already looks like he's had a couple, but wouldn't you? Damn mainstream media. Jared and Ivanka breezed in and out after a single sugar-free Cosmo each. You don't know Don Jr. well, but you also don't want to interrupt him when he's chatting up a frankly spectacular blonde who sure as hell isn't from Washington. You like it. It's the new establishment of Donald Trump's Washington. These are the people you'll fight side by side with for the next 8 years. Your old business partners from your lobbying firm are there every night in the same booth with a rotating cast of luminaries from Trump's orbit. They're bringing in so much business, and you're happy to play the role of the big man. Your aide, who is probably too smart for her own good, tells you this is like the Algonquin Hotel of the Trump era, and you wonder what she meant. You think she's being sarcastic and you don't like it, but this is a night to celebrate. You knock back a last Pappy Van Winkle, say your goodnights, and roll out. Tomorrow morning, that big black Suburban with government plates is going to roll up in front of the house you bought in Georgetown to appease your latest wife and take you to your office. It's time to get shit done. Chapter 2. Furrowed brows and deep concern. By now, you've all become familiar with the catalog of Republican excuses for Donald Trump. You've watched them politely look away from Trump's excesses, missteps, racist asides, and other lunacies and utter excuses of such spectacular banality that it takes a moment to process how truly mendacious their words are in the face of reality. Trump has broken some essential political survival mechanism in Republican elected officials, and it's hard to see how many of them will recover. Over and over, Republicans have failed a basic political common sense test on Trump. The excuses they make for him are so out of proportion to the reaction he deserves. In the face of incompetence, they display indifference. In the face of corruption, they engage in epic whataboutism. In the face of instability, they blame inexperience. To understand how Trump has changed the GOP for the worse, it's important to recognize the tribal divisions inside the Republican Party today. The following typology should help. A typology of congressional Republicans. 1. The true believers. While the GOP base is still largely positive about Donald Trump, the actual number of fire-breathing 24/7 members of the Trump-Hottie caucus is astonishingly small. The true believers in Trumpism overlap heavily, and ironically, with the Freedom Caucus, the group of hard-right Republicans who claim to believe in limited government, personal freedom, balanced budgets, and the elimination of debt and deficits. These are the Steve Kings, Mark Meadows, Devin Nunes, and Jim Jordans of the world. I could write more about them, but honestly, they're tenacious and boring and will be first up against the wall come the revolution. 2. The opportunists. In the Senate, Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham play Trump's game in pursuit of their own ends. Both men have agenda items they want to move. In McConnell's case, on the economic front, and in Graham's, on foreign policy. They're both entirely aware of who and what Trump is and quite overtly play to his weaknesses to keep him out of their knitting. Their praise of Trump isn't some esoteric mystery. It's a cost of doing business and a way of distracting the toddler-in-chief with shiny objects. There are a dozen opportunists in the House Trump camp, young, full of hustle, and eager to get on Fox News. They only look like the aforementioned true believers. They're not. These guys are conning the con man. One example is Matt Gaetz of Northwestern Florida's 1st Congressional District. You've seen Matt on 100 cable news shows. Young, dark-haired, and slowly going to seed, he looks like a frat boy wearing his father's suit. Matt comes from a political family. His father was president of the Florida Senate, and Matt served in the Florida House from the tender age of 22. He has an eye for the main chance and a nose in the wind. As full-time Trump cheer squad members, Matt and others have worked the con man-in-chief like champions, playing to his vanity, giving Fox News the kind of pro-Trump talking head action money can't buy. But it rings more than a little hollow. The ambitions of the opportunist class are vividly apparent. In the meantime, Matt and the others are harvesting cash from building out their email lists of the credulous Trump fan base. 3. The cowards. Every week, at least a couple of members of Congress call me as their father confessor to admit their sins and avow their hatred of Trump. They're publicly loyal to Trump for three reasons: FOMT, FOTB, and BTP. These three acronyms explain all of their behavior. FOMT, fear of mean tweets. Donald Trump's superpower is his ability to turn his 50 million social media followers into an unguided, deafening weapon against anyone he targets. Folks like Jeff Flake, Ben Sasse, and Dean Heller and others who have been attacked by Donald Trump on social media find their phone lines jammed, their email boxes filled with poorly capitalized and grammatically disastrous screeds, their social media accounts flooded with Trump memes, and their ability to communicate suppressed in a tidal wave of hate and death threats. The fear of Trump tweeting a member of Congress with an attack is ever-present and terrifies them into silence. FOTB, fear of Trump's base. Somewhere along the line, members of the Trump base became objects of terror to members of Congress. One congressman told me of a moment when he was mildly critical of Trump in a town hall meeting, and within minutes, people were posting threats to his Facebook page, blowing up his phone, and mentioning how they hoped he'd support Mr. Trump. The Mr. is always a tell. Because otherwise, how would the congressman's kids grow up without a father? These aren't Republicans as we once knew them. They're more feral, more fierce, and wildly less conservative. The narrow line between statism and conservatism is in the rearview mirror of their ratty, clapped-out beaters. They're angry at everything, all the time. And they increasingly believe in vivid conspiracy theories that members of Congress with an ounce of sense won't touch with a 10-foot pole. BTP. But the primary. The fear that Donald Trump will cause a Trump-centric primary challenger to run against an incumbent Republican member is constant and sharp. When Steve Bannon was still in the Trump orbit, he was promising to field Trumpish challengers to every Republican running for Senate, save Ted Cruz. Members have told me over and over they live in terror of one tweet from Trump praising some nutcase, causing their primary to become a reality TV show called Who's More Trump? The cowards are by far the majority in the Republican caucus. Even as they defend him publicly, they loathe him privately. Many of them are a part of a large number of 2018 retirements. If you're ever looking for profiles in chicken shit, these members are your finest exemplars. 4. The rationalizers. You've heard all the variations. We've got to pass X. He's new to this. Oh, that's just Trump tweeting. We'll work it out in private. He's not a typical politician. He's settling into the job. Those excuses are as common as they are untrue. The rationalizer's permissive parent style of governing works about as well as letting your kids subsist on a diet of cookie dough and television. Kids need discipline, and when Donald Trump's rationalizers talk about his unfocused childlike behavior, it's never with any parental firmness or authority. I wish he'd stop tweeting so much is the equivalent of, little Donald is so bright, but I wish he'd focus in class. The president isn't a conventional politician, translates as, we hope Donnie will channel his creativity and stop setting fires and dissecting roadkill in the kitchen. Paul Ryan was the leader of the Rationalizer Caucus, desperately trying to derive order from Trump's chaos. Ryan wanted to manage Trump so that he and the GOP caucus could run on the tax cut, the economy, and infrastructure. All of these messages went out the window, and Ryan owns his share of the blame. Too often, he behaved as if he were some deferential junior VP at a Trump resort, and not the leader of the House of Representatives in a co-equal branch of government. The idea, popular among the rationalizers, that a diet of their ass-kissing and deference would make Trump a normal president who responded to normal political cues was always a mistake. 5. The retirees. Retirement frees Republican members to speak the truth, and boy do they ever. It's a damn shame they had to wait until they declared they were done with leadership to speak the awful truths about Trump. But it's also a small reminder that some conservatives still believe in something more than the maximum leader. Jeff Flake's amazing floor speech on the risks of Trump was roundly mocked in the Trump-right media, but will go down in history as a moment when, under terrible pressure, an American politician took the hard road, told the truth, and called out a member of his party. When it comes to trifling, chicken-hawk, no-account pud-knockers like Donald Trump, John McCain left his last fucks on the floor of the Hanoi Hilton. In an era where political heroes are thin on the ground, McCain's almost never pulled a punch with Trump, and even in the twilight of his life, McCain is still swinging for the fences. Trump's attacks on McCain fell flat, because one man is a hero to millions, the other only in his own mind. After his diagnosis of brain cancer in the fall of 2017, McCain's light has been fading, but his fire and fight never did. Even Trey Gowdy, the chairman of the House Oversight Committee and scourge of Hillary Clinton's role in the Benghazi attack, was born again hard after announcing his retirement. Gowdy, once a hero of the Trump right and the Fox News set, became anathema when he finally called bullshit on the White House's lawlessness and chaos. The 5 stages of Trumpsplaining. Imagine a world where Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama sat in a White House meeting and casually brought up a willingness to ban assault weapons, belittled fellow party members for being afraid of the National Rifle Association, and just threw out the idea of bypassing due process to seize firearms. What would happen? I'll tell you what would happen. The GOP, every conservative publication, and every single Republican member of Congress would be tearing their damn hair out. The wailing and lamentation would shatter the heavens. But Trump did all those things on February 28, 2018, when he sat in a cabinet room gun control roundtable in the wake of the Parkland, Florida school shooting. It was a moment Second Amendment advocates and NRA supporters were waiting for. They had worked their hearts out for their guy, and with the most consequential push for sweeping gun control in a generation, they needed him to stand firm on their issue. So, of course, gun rights advocates, NRA members, and rank-and-file conservatives were aghast when Trump ran into the waiting arms of Dianne Feinstein and other pro-gun control advocates. Shocker, I know. The man he claimed to be on the campaign trail, a rigid, uncompromising fighter for the Second Amendment, disappeared. Even Breitbart News, the house organ of Trumpism, ran a Trump the Gun Grabber headline. A few days later, Democrats who thought they could touch fecal Midas and get away with it were disappointed when he flipped on gun control again and did virtually nothing. This weather-vane political positioning caused the same kind of whiplash for Republicans during the disastrous Obamacare repeal fight. In that debacle, the president described one version of the congressional GOP repeal plan as mean, while berating Republican members of the Senate and House via Twitter and calling legislative audibles at the worst possible moments. It happened again over DACA, the Obama-era executive order protecting the American-born children of illegal aliens from deportation. The build the wall and ship them home version of Donald Trump sat in a room full of legislators and said he'd support, quote, the clean DACA bill, sans border security provisions. White House advisor and immigration hawk Stephen Miller looked as if he was about to crap out a kitten, and House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy had to correct the president sharply. For just a moment, Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi probably couldn't believe their luck. Pelosi must have been thinking, he can't be this stupid. Trust me, Nancy, he is that stupid. Until Republicans' apoplectic responses penetrated even Trump's consciousness, Trump was ready to make a deal right that minute. Trump is a creature almost preternaturally aware of the media climate around him and of the shifting moods of the public. In event after event, he's obviously influenced by what he sees on television. For him, ideology and philosophy do not mediate politics. Television mediates politics. More specifically, television is the only place where the coverage of any crisis, story, or issue reflects on his mental brand image. He thinks he is, or at least should be, the star of every story. These examples are hardly unique, and they certainly don't cover every single time that Donald Trump opened his mouth and blew up his party or conservative orthodoxy during his campaign and first year in office. Even more corrosive is the rhetorical, ideological, and political gymnastics required of Republican leaders, conservative media, and the conservative movement every time Trump straps verbal Semtex to his body and hits the detonator. He's president, hold my beer, watch this, and everyone stands riveted to the spot, waiting for the calamity. Stage 1. Oops, I pooped myself. This is how it always begins. Trump verbally soils himself in public with an embarrassing statement, lunatic theory, early morning golden toilet tweet, or a throwaway line he thinks will make him look good on the next round of cable news coverage. He does this because he sees everything through the narrow, blinkered framework of his role as a reality TV game show host and pitchman. But everyone, friend or foe, still seems surprised every time. He never seems to realize the impact of his words, the damage he's about to cause, or the mess he forces others to clean up. This includes wild departures from conservative ideology, fiscal reality, American tradition, common sense, and the established models of physics. The elevator drop sensation when Trump screws the pooch in the press has left Republicans numb, shell-shocked, and sleepless. It's why time seems to dilate in the age of Trump. A month is a week, and a week is a year, and Jesus Christ, what did he just tweet? Stage 2. So stupid, it burns. Republicans in Congress, Trump's media allies, and his more intelligent supporters instantly feel a pain akin to being set on fire and then dunked in acid. In Trump's cabinet set-piece meetings, you can always see the grim looks on their faces the moment he steps in it. Their downcast eyes lock on the White House notepads placed on the table before them. The suddenly rigid postures and thousand-yard stares of Republican leaders in these moments are inadvertently hilarious. You can almost hear the mental gears turning, grinding out rationalizations and excuses to reconfigure whatever batshit lunacy just sprang from his brow like bad idea Athena. You can watch them mortgaging one more fraction of their dignity and sanity as the man they praise is the perfectly normal, totally not insane, best president ever who, unlike all the losers before him, is making America great again, has done the impossible by lowering the bar a few more notches. Stage 3. But her emails. His media myrmidons recognize he's done it again and know that their next 48 hours will be spent crafting a series of high-wire, hot-take absurdities in defense of the indefensible. These stories almost always include a portfolio of excuses for this president as someone who isn't a traditional politician and is new at this. They defend it as Trump being Trump and unleash a wave of epic whataboutism. The land echoes with cries of "But Obama" and "But Hillary." You can count on Trump-right rodeo clowns like Sean Hannity to dredge up old favorites from their fantasy catalog, Why isn't Robert Mueller investigating Bill Clinton's love child? Were Hillary and Huma Abedin secretly gay married by George Soros? Tonight, Sebastian Gorka will join us to rip the lid off the secret mosque Barack Obama built under the Rose Garden. These appeals to raw, partisan tribalism work in our current political climate, and the lurid, fanciful horrors described by Trump's defenders start to snap MAGA voters and votaries back into line. Why, without Trump's straight talk and disruptive nature, we'd be hip-deep in Antifa super soldiers, ISIS terrorists, pedophiles, and MS-13 gangbangers. Only Donald's force of will is holding back the invasion of wily Chinese and rapey Mexicans and stopping the local shawarma stand operator from detonating his bomb vest. A casual listener or reader would think Kenyan communist Muslim sleeper agent Barack Hussein Obama is still in office. From these breathless stories, it would be easy to imagine President Hillary Clinton is running roughshod over the land in her attempt to impose Sharia-compliant cultural Marxism. Don't ask. They don't know what it means either. All while operating a chain of pedo-friendly pizza restaurants. Stage 4. Magical Rationalization. When all else fails, it's time to go for the magical thinking defenses of Trump. You just don't get him, man. He's a dealmaker, not a politician. Trump's got this. He's playing 47-dimensional quantum chess, Rhino. So much winning. It's a living, breathing embodiment of the emperor's new clothes, except his followers never get to the crux of the parable. They race to frame Trump's absurdities into some kind of explicable fact pattern, to find some secret, subtle strategy where none exists. The idea that Trump always has some deeply considered game plan, some rationale for every action, some hidden endgame in mind is, of course, ludicrous. But it doesn't stop this defense from being run through the Trump-friendly media channels on the far right on an almost daily basis. Michelle Goldberg of the New York Times wrote a fabulous piece about the ultimate Trump conspiracy, called The Conspiracy Theory That Says Trump is a Genius. It beautifully captures this odd element of the Trump cult's magical rationalization. His supporters believe in their heart that Trump is a deep thinker, a master planner, a strategist nonpareil. This late-stage element of defending Trump is wearing increasingly thin. Reality, as they say, is a heartless bitch. Stage 5. Waiting to exhale. In this stage, the scope of the latest political pratfall is clear, and even his allies have to face reality. They start to quietly pick up the pieces, redacting, patching, revising and extending remarks, and deploying all the other tools of the political janitorial staff. After Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, or desperate, terrified White House staff have cleaned up his mess enough to walk around without wearing wellies, and Trump-splained his more crazy assertions, more intelligent Trump supporters leave a quiet sigh of relief and recognize they've dodged one more bullet. Then, a delicious amnesia sets in, and the cycle repeats itself. Trump springs some rhetorical turd on them, leaving his followers surprised when his next political disaster, policy malapropism, or self-inflicted wound embarrasses them and the nation. Loving Donald Trump somehow prevents them from believing it can ever happen again, and that Trump won't do the same thing in a day or two on some new issue or some new crisis. Lucy always pulls the football away at the last second. The scorpion always bites the frog. By now they should know quite well that Donald Trump has only the most tenuous appreciation for the power of the office of president. They should know he's both uneducated and uneducable. Trump is no fan of briefings that don't come in graphic novel form or of knowing the specifics of legislation or policy proposals. They should know he's malleable, crass, and dishonest, and that all he cares about is serving his swolt ego. The fact they still act surprised and go right back into the five-stage pattern speaks volumes about how far they've fallen and how little they care. The political costs of kissing Trump's ass. Why does Trump kill all that he touches? In part, because he requires every man and woman in his orbit to destroy themselves to remain in his good graces. He requires every person near him to constantly stroke the mighty bonfire of his narcissism and to ramp up the praise until it butts into pure idolatry. It isn't enough for Trump to have support. He breaks down every relationship into its most protean form. All politicians are inclined to some degree of narcissism. It's a necessary offset to the endless small indignities. all politicians, no matter their public image, are needy bitches. Donald Trump takes that hunger, that constant gnawing desire for love, affirmation, and praise, to a level unknown in American political history. One doesn't become president without a healthy ego, but no president has been more obsessed with being the center of attention and praise. It's a sick addiction and a driver for so many of his pathologies. He also requires a degree of moral and ideological flexibility where nothing that came before matters. Nothing today can be expected to persist. Everything Trump says is mutable, subject to instantaneous revision, no matter the political cost to those defending him. Virtually every Republican elected official has learned that Trump is a man of moods, of ephemeral interests, and with little regard for the record. For Trump, the past isn't prologue. It simply doesn't exist. Nothing he says, does, or promises is real for longer than his gnat-like attention span can hold it in his wee brain. I've been around D.C. and American politics for quite a while now, far longer than the average bear. I'm struck over and over again how little sense of dignity and self-preservation today's D.C. Republicans have. Yes, Trump blew up the old rules, but there's only one thing you have in politics at the end of the day, and that's your reputation. How you behave, what you do, who you work with and for all still matter, even in the reign of King Donald the Mad. Are we back in the days of the more genteel Bush 41 era? Of course not. But imagining Reagan, Bush 41, or Bush 43 demanding the same kind of abnegation Trump requires is impossible. Do the good guys working for Trump understand this? We may never know. They steadfastly refuse even to consider that enabling Trump doesn't keep the rabid wolves like Bannon out. It just releases Trump to act on his id. In doing so, it widens the gap between Republicans and the rest of America dramatically. No, Paul Ryan isn't a skirt-chasing, Putin-philic, lavishly corrupt scumbag. Mitch McConnell isn't a pussy-grabbing, porn star-screwing maniac. Get that image out of your head. I dare you. Even so, the stench and politically radioactive ichor of Trump covers them in every other Republican. The perception grew from reality. Ryan and his cohorts will, in fact, defend any outrage. This vicious cycle gave Trump a sense that no line was too far, no outrage is too grand, no lie is too egregious. He didn't learn that the rule of law and the Constitution bind even the mighty powers of the president. He learned Mom and Dad were at the beach house and left the car keys and a credit card on the kitchen table. Where were the people who would put country over party? Nowhere in Congress, that's certain. What you can find in Congress is any number of Republicans willing to trash-talk the president off the record. GOP members I've spoken to in the past year and a half have repeatedly told me they loathe and fear this president. One member told me, "You know that scene in The Hunt for Red October where the guy torpedoes his own submarine? You fool, you've killed us all!" That's him. Another member, writes the resurgence Eric Erickson, said he sees Trump as an evil, really fucking stupid Forrest Gump. These aren't the purple state squishes of Trump fans' imaginations. They are, or at least were, rock-ribbed, red state, red meat conservatives. That Trump continues to receive praise from them, instead of condemnation, and cheers instead of catcalls, is an element of his disastrous first year in office. It's an endorsement of his shock-jock leadership style, and a permanent mark against the one group of men and women who could have stopped that behavior and yet utterly refused to take responsibility for doing so. It's hard to imagine a scenario where Republicans could embarrass themselves more thoroughly than they already have, but Donald Trump will drag them down time and again, no matter what they believe about him. He is the eternal Loki, a trickster god drawn to listening only to what Edgar Allan Poe calls the imp of the perverse. It's become a bit exhausting reminding them that the world doesn't have to be this way. Over and over they touch the hot stove, ignore the angry howls from their constituents, and continue to defend the indefensible. What to expect when you're working for Trump? Act 3. No sooner have you settled into your comfortable office and begun to make America great again than you notice Donald Trump's ardor has cooled. His praise has become mere tolerance, and your glory suddenly tastes a bit sour. Watching him in action, you quickly learn one thing about this king's mercurial moods and white-hot temper. It's best to turn the praise and ostentatious displays of loyalty up to 11 every day. You notice that the president isn't just a one-way street, but that he also demands that his allies do things that aren't, you know, appropriate. He doesn't care about the statutes or those ethics rules that were designed for the unwashed little people. He wants his wishes fulfilled. Toot sweet. You saw his incandescent rage after Jeff Sessions recused himself over the Russia investigation. You quickly correct yourself, witch hunt. And you don't ever want to be on the receiving end of those tweets. In the meantime, life is good. There's no adult supervision. You're in charge of your fiefdom. Sure, you could order a conference table from IKEA, but why not have one that requires 100 acres of pristine rainforest lumber be cut down and built by an army of slave labor instead? If you're going to MAGA, don't you deserve a security detail large enough to overthrow a third world nation? While it's fun blowing through traffic with lights flashing and sirens blaring, except for all the small liberties, you really have almost no power. There's rarely an actual agenda or program from the White House. Mostly, you're chasing the rabbit of the president's daily whims and interests. Some days he'll announce a policy solidly in your department's ambit via tweet. You won't know it's coming. The White House staff won't know it's coming. Like a plague, it just appears, sudden and deadly. From the lowest Hill staffer to the most isolated GS9 in the bureaucratic hinterlands, no one in Washington likes that. Washington hates surprises, disorder, and things outside the lanes and traditions. As a cabinet member or senior aide, it makes your hackles rise, but what can you do? Sure, you'll keep tweaking the regulatory stuff and going through the kabuki dance with Congress, but you know you're mostly along for the ride. Right about this time is when you start quietly asking friends, is leaving after a year okay, or is it 18 months? Chapter 3. Running with the Devil. America's evangelicals sold themselves to Trump for 40 pieces of silver. A degenerate, unrepentant man who represents everything evangelicals have railed against for generations bought their loyalty for nearly nothing. It remains one of the most remarkable aspects of the campaign of 2016 and of the presidency of Donald Trump. Trump's personal depravity isn't a secret. His amoral, deeply vainglorious nature isn't hidden under the proverbial bushel. It is the sum of his entire character. His religious beliefs and ties are, at their very best, loose. One author describes Trump's faith as nonchalant Christianity. In Iowa, Trump said, "When I drink my little wine, have my little cracker, I guess that's a form of asking for forgiveness, and I do that as often as possible because I feel cleansed. I think in terms of let's go on and let's make it right." I'm not entirely sure which doctrinal strain of Christianity that represents, but I believe it emerges from the First Church of Greed, Manhattan Synod. Trump's only faith is in himself, and his only God is mammon. His obsession with money and the trappings of wealth don't exactly scream out that this is a guy who will pass through the eye of a needle, but perhaps I'm just not up on my prosperity gospel. I know many evangelicals. No, I'm not doing the my black friend for the God Squad. I mean it. I know a lot of evangelicals. I'm not one, but many I know are some of the most good-hearted people you could ever hope to meet. They live their faith, do good works, give generously to their communities, both in time and tithing. They once had standards and applied them to their politics. I didn't always agree with those standards, but they had them. Until 2016. That was the year the political and professional evangelicals went off the cliff with a candidate who was a walking, talking, porn star-screwing offense to their every belief. Suddenly, nothing mattered. The TV pastor class of Jerry Falwell Jr.'s were out building their own version of the golden calf statue the moment Trump slithered into their megachurches. I'm not enough of a biblical scholar to give you the perfect reference, but something about the road to hell being both broad and smooth comes to mind. Sure, there were hints in the political ecosystem that not all the members of the God Squad were, shall we say, living their beliefs. During a statewide primary election a few years back, a prominent evangelical said of my candidate, "Well, I know he's 100% pro-life, but he's not very vocal about it." This guy's favored candidate in the race had two restraining orders against him and was so far to the right he was utterly unelectable, but it's a miracle. had generously donated to the construction fund for said evangelical's megachurch. Another prominent evangelical leader's conduct with his multiple girlfriends over the past two decades led to his having the nickname The Strangler. One evangelical who frequently rails against the sin of gay marriage may have a pretty young thing for a wife, but she lacks the one physical aspect that truly makes him see the face of God, which is to say, a penis. I know people, and church people do love to talk, Proverbs 11:13 aside. It should have been a preview, but all of a sudden Donald Trump came along and washed away all the prior disqualifiers. All the things evangelicals had said for generations that made a candidate anathema were suddenly just fine. Let's review, shall we? Many evangelicals told me that casinos and the venal, sinful atmosphere they create are deeply corrupting moral influences. Apparently not. Donald didn't run his casinos with even the thin veneer of the family friendliness of modern Vegas. The Trump Taj Mahal in Atlantic City was a humid, grim dump, fleecing seniors of their social security just like Jesus preached in the Gospel of Skies. It looked, felt, and smelled like a strip club come low-stakes roadside casino. Every surface was sticky, and you did not want to know why. I can't recall which book of the Bible says, "Thou shalt take Granny's social security check and collect it for the Lord's slot machines." I was taught that divorce was a calamitous social evil and to be avoided at all costs. Apparently not. I mean, Trump has only had two of them so far, both caused by rampant adultery, but MAGA, right? Is that from the book of Gorsuch? I think it might be. Fucking, oh, pardon me, dating porn stars while your wife is pregnant and then paying them hush money is frowned upon in modern Christianity, yes? Apparently, naming the right court nominees expiates that particular sin in the eyes of the God Squad. Oh, he did it more than once? Well, forgiveness is next to Trumpishness when it comes to evangelicals handing out moral mulligans. Being a goddamn degenerate pussy grabber with a lifetime of adultery, venality, and dishonesty is not, to my knowledge, one of the core tenets of the Christian faith. I can't find it in either the Old or New Testament, and I'm not sure which book of the Apocrypha the pussy grabber exception comes in, but as noted earlier, I'm no biblical scholar. Trump has opened entirely new theological avenues. Until now, forgiveness was always available as long as repentance was in the mix. There is literally not one aspect of Trump's behavior, as a citizen, a husband, and as a man, that shows even the slightest scintilla of repentance for anything, ever. It used to be that supporting candidates who backed abortion, ever, was a permanent stain, a terminal moral and political disqualifier, and made one an ally of industrialized infanticide. Now, mirabile dictu! Trump gave Schumer, Pelosi, and Hillary Clinton hundreds of thousands of dollars over the years. No big deal. It's the divine miracle of amnesia. After Trump entered the race, evangelicals were strangely incurious about his history with abortion, for he had been staunchly pro-abortion until 2016. Our Oppo researcher dug up a telling quote from a 2016 interview with Maureen Dowd. When asked by the New York Times columnist if, during his swinging bachelor days in New York City, he'd ever been involved with someone who had an abortion, Trump sneeringly replied, "Such an interesting question. So what's your next question?" One last note on abortion is relevant to a story told to me before Trump joined the race. A close friend of Trump's, one of his most passionate defenders today, explained to me why Trump would never enter the presidential contest by telling me, "The last conversation Trump ever has with one of his girls is when she calls and says, 'Don, I'm late,' or when he gets bored with her. At that point, Cohen and his people take over. NDA, payout, go away. It's all in Cohen's office. You can't have that come out." This was well before Stormy Daniels was a household name. The Cohen in question is, of course, Michael Cohen, the now notorious sleaze consigliere for Trump's wandering hands and penis. Imagine being a man who spends many of his waking moments working to cover up, pay off, intimidate, and silence women. Given that Cohen's degree from a strip mall law school may not be good for much else, I guess we can't begrudge him the work. But Cohen became famous in 2018 when the aforementioned system of handling Trump's bimbo eruptions became public knowledge, and his role in the notorious Stormy Daniels affair reduced him to a national laughingstock. Evangelicals have been a core part of the Republican coalition since the 1970s. But the era of Trump makes it perfectly clear they have no problem at all with big intrusive government powers and executive orders being deployed to shape social policies they find desirable. Trump understood how to parlay their sense of beleaguered social and political inferiority into a message claiming that he would aggressively pursue their ends, even if it meant ignoring that pesky Constitution and the will of the people. Barack Obama kicked our ass down the street twice by growing the Democratic coalition. It's a zero-sum game, and every gain for them is a loss for us. It's a cliche, but you grow by addition, always and only. Too much of the evangelical political agenda became associated with exclusion, alienation, and a disconnection with the society at large. Changing hearts and minds in a society that has passed them by on many issues is boring and hard work. They'd rather compromise with a candidate who will nominate their preferred judges than uphold their values. Instead of working to change society through moral suasion, exemplars of faith, or even just better communications, they'd rather trust the federal government in the hands of Donald Trump to deliver their desired social end states. Call me crazy, but I thought that was the other team's modus operandi. Evangelicals are the dead-enders of the Trump world, a phenomenon explained both by demographics and geographic distribution. The southern and midwestern states where they live are Trump country writ large. He is their golden calf, and the leaders of the evangelical movement repeat daily, "This is your God who brought you up out of Egypt." Despite being a majority in the American religious landscape, they continue to feel as if they're under constant attack from secular culture, the media, and the government. They've lost battles in the court of public opinion over gay marriage that have been a core part of their messaging since Anita Bryant in the 1970s. Trump brilliantly plays that sense of alienation, promising, as he always does, to be their avenger, a flawed vessel for their agenda, but their vessel nonetheless. What to expect when you're working for Trump? Act 4. Uh-oh. Now you've done it. You were just trying to be on the team and promote the MAGA message. You punched all the "this president is so amazing" buttons your press aide got from Sarah and Kellyanne. You tugged your forelock, subsumed your ego, and promised bigly successes across the board. Then the question came out of left field and you made a huge, devastating mistake. You actually answered it. You damn fool. Mueller, Russian sanctions, climate change, the tax bill, the ludicrous plan to build a wall. It doesn't matter what it was. It's that your statement got attention, more attention than the president did that day. Now, you're sitting in the dark in your Georgetown townhouse, plowing down your third old ocelot on the rocks, feeling as if gravity has switched off and your career is about to end in a blaze of Twitter fury from the Donald. You sleep fitfully, if at all. In the morning, though, the reviews are good. It seems like you actually did something right for an administration that needs all the wins it can get. You get a little bounce in your step until a new, icy realization settles in your gut. There's only one star in this firmament, and that star is Donald Trump. The favorable attention about how smart, insightful, driven, strategic, or effective you are is rage bait for Trump. And even if you don't end up on the receiving end of his fury that day, the second you become a star for even one moment longer than the president, the game starts to wind down. Chapter 4. That's why you got Trump. Dear Democrats, this chapter is for you. Sure, my Republican and independent readers may still glean some amusement or information from it, but I hope you'll pay attention. Here's the truth. Democrats are bad at politics. No, really. You are holistically bad at politics, both on Election Day and in the cut and thrust of Washington, and your lack of skills is often Trump's best ally. This chapter will look at why that is true and give you a bit of unsolicited advice. Because you really, really need it. Oh, you'll object, I know. You'll race right to the fact that Barack Obama beat the GOP in two blowout national elections, and you're right. By all means, rest on those laurels, but how have you done since then? It's been a goddamn train wreck, and you need to face that. Since 2008, you've lost a presidential race to Donald Trump. Donald fucking Trump.